Philip, can you talk a little bit about how you got involved in Occupy ICE and what drew you down to the camp in the first place? Because you were there almost from the start of the encampment.
Right. Yeah. First off, thank you for having me. Occupy ICE, you know, obviously we had a lot of concerns that we were dealing with. We were protesting the imprisonment of families, the abuse and sexual abuse and sexual violence against people, the detainment of children, the starvation of people, the death. None of that was acceptable for me and for anyone else there. And the fact that Oregon is supposed to be a sanctuary city, a place where we can you know, have any person be welcome and be safe here, and to have ICE set up in a city like that is unconscionable. And so Occupy ICE was incredible. It was exciting for me. I wanted to go right from the get-go because I believed in what we were doing. And really what made me, you know, join right off the bat was because of my experience with other protests, being involved with Don't Shoot Portland, Portland Resistance, March for Our Lives, Black Lives Matter, and other varieties of groups that have occupations and protests here in the city. There's a lot of groups where I feel safe. And so this was another place where I knew that I felt safe because there were people that I was familiar with. And of course, when I, you know, showed up, I saw a lot of people from these various groups that were there together. And I know that Portland really got nationwide and actually international attention just right off the bat. And taking advantage of that, we wanted to bring attention to accessibility. And so between me and Andrew, my one of the interpreters that was there, we talked about trying to set up an accessibility team of interpreters that work together with the teams that the camp already had, like a medical team, an accessibility team, you know, a camp split up into mental health and engineering and everything. And so we kind of offered our services and our knowledge and said that, you know, money can always be an issue, but it doesn't have to be in this situation. We brought together a team of volunteers who were willing to provide accessibility for accessibility's sake and to support what the camp was doing and what they needed. If a deaf person, you know, wanted to come into the camp, you know, they had accessibility. And this is, you know, incongruent with the activity of the government. If a deaf person or a deaf immigrant is detained, there's typically not accessibility given to them at any part of that experience. And so I really vehemently wanted to support that cause there and bring the accessibility struggle and apply it to that. Language barriers, you know, of spoken language between just Spanish and English is the same concept of me as a deaf person not being able to speak English or, you know, spoken English and needing American Sign Language. So we have intersectionality of these problems, and we should be pulling together our resources and see a lot of movements around the city and around the world where people are live streaming. But this is typically a problem because there's no captions, there's no accessibility. So oftentimes the deaf and hard of hearing or other non-English speaking communities have to depend on transcripts or even the media, where often information is not completely given and the full story is not provided. And so at times we would have the interpreters or even me myself explaining what we see, what's going on in ASL, so the deaf community can see it for themselves and discern that information for ourselves, you know. And if a community member sees someone that they know, then maybe they get excited and want to, you know, get in there too, and feeding that deaf community with knowledge and empowering them with what was going on. Because again, the world was watching Occupy ICE in Portland. And so it was a moment where we wanted to really take the opportunity to expose the world and educate them to how crucial it was to provide accessibility during these movements and these sort of actions. And so that's what really attracted to me and to the camp in the first place. And during the second and third week, I had schedule conflicts, so I wasn't there as much as I would have liked to be, but definitely in the beginning we set that bar and it was amazing.
Yeah, and I gather, you know, this is the second part of our interview. We started talking with Andrew earlier, and I gather that this was a really nationally groundbreaking move toward creating that access and that nearly continuous translation. It sounds like it might have also been potentially an internationally groundbreaking move. Is that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, because I and other members of the deaf community got together and wanted to talk to the different people in camp, and they were so willing to talk to us too. You know, there were other people that were there, even during interviews, just, you know, conversations. We got to hang out with what camp and see what it looked like because of the accessibility that was there. You know, we got to interact with people on a personal level, and that was amazing. That the opportunity really opens our mind to know how these people are interacting with each other. How can we actually support each other? What does accessibility truly, truly look like? And so that's where we, you know, got to develop that empathy, that awareness, that relationship with each other, you know, because again, if you're going to depend on media information, there might be a spin, there might be sensationalized, you know, stories that don't match what actually happens. And that's what happened with Occupy. You know, a lot of the stories that came out really sensationalized us to sound violent or a lot more active than we were, but we really provided interpreters for vigils. We interpreted for speakers who were sharing their stories. It wasn't that they were just there for one or two speakers or 1 hour, but they were really there to give us the chance to interact with other people there and to see the truth for ourselves and to learn the information for ourselves. And, you know, speaking nationwide, I'm hoping that other protests and other actions are inspired by what happened, and they will think of us in Portland and what we did and how successful we were in providing that, and that every time they go to make a movement and to do something else, that they think of us. And these are just seeds that we're trying to plant nationally and internationally, and hope that they grow and are cultivated by people in other cities. Because, you know, it's not just about providing the accessibility for a protest, but that then leaks into, you know, the importance of accessibility in any sort of police interaction. So it's important to have accessibility at a protest, because what if officers show up and there's an escalation? You know, in the deaf community, we're at such a high risk of harm and miscommunication and misunderstanding. And oftentimes we don't go to these type of protests because we're scared of police activity and lack of accessibility. So even having the opportunity with an interpreter to interact with the police on my level for at my time and my way, it was a huge step for our involvement, and hopefully we'll just continue to see it grow from there.
Yeah, and I mean, you've been laying kind of the foundation for this kind of wall-to-wall accessibility for a long time, it sounds like, through your activism. I know you noted you spoke to a number of movements that you've been involved with, and do you want to talk more about kind of how this has been, how the seeds were planted for this pretty big leap that you took with Occupy?
Yeah, I would say, well, first off, I've never experienced really leading a true protest. I've been involved in a lot of protests that were inaccessible, where I would catch some information, but there was no interpreter. So I would catch, you know, some words on the mouths of some people, or if someone was, you know, willing to text it to me or just give me that information. And I'd have to work double and triple as hard just to get half the information, reading articles as they, you know, release information through the media. So that's what kind of led me to my fervor in wanting to be more involved. So I actually did recently host a protest myself. I led that successfully, and I was hoping that that would make change. And I knew that it's not just a one-time thing. It would require me to show up again and again to show my commitment, so that the community would show their commitment back to me and hopefully provide resources and prepare for that. And so, you know, my repeated presence just built a trust with these groups, and it led to the point where, you know, when Occupy started, we already had a team of interpreters that were ready and willing to go. We had leaders that were willing and ready to make that happen and support us. And, you know, I think that that fire really happened when I last fall led my protest. We had ASL interpreters that spoke through a megaphone for me as I was signing to the crowd. We marched in the streets. I had signed permits. We followed all the city codes. I contacted officers so that they knew what we were doing, so that everyone who was there would be safe. And that experience was incredible. Being able to show the city that leading a protest is not just for hearing people. Me as a deaf person, I can lead in action. I can provide access and interpreters myself. It's possible. And all of these other hearing people and all of these other leaders who don't provide access, I hope that this would be a wake-up call for them, that it is possible and it is easy. And so that was a really, truly inspiring moment for me. Very, very powerful. And that carried on through Occupy.
And that protest centered around?
My protest actually was about ending police brutality. So that was a very, you know, sensitive topic and a very heavy, heavy issue in our city and around the nation. So I think it takes a lot of guts for people to step forward and lead something like that. And especially, you know, me as a deaf person, it was historical. So
Yeah. Do you want to talk more about how you feel police brutality is particularly impacting the deaf community and the hard of hearing community in Portland?
Absolutely. So I want you to tell me, actually, I have a question for you. And maybe the public who's thinking this could think for themselves as well. When the police fail to de-escalate a situation with an able-bodied person, how can we then expect an officer to de-escalate when someone has a disability? It's scary to think about from my perspective. Just interacting with police, I've had a number of communication barriers that lead to immediate escalation that have led to traumatic situations for me and a lot of other deaf and hard of hearing people. Especially here in Portland, where our deaf community has not yet had a high visibility with our officers. Our officers are not trained in interacting with the deaf and hard of hearing members of our Portland community. And I was fortunate enough to have the Department of Public Safety Standards training invite me to be there for 6 months as a role player, working different scenarios with officers as a deaf person. So as new officers came in, they didn't know that I was deaf. It wasn't until the actual role play scenario where they were found out and had to, you know, work around and figure out what to do in that situation. So it gave me an opportunity to give direct feedback. Say, imagine if I'm deaf, but I also have a mental health crisis. What are you going to do? Do you have resources? Do you know? What is your training say about that? And a lot of times the officers didn't have an answer, and that's not okay with me. I should be confident and know that my officers have resources and have solutions ready for me. And so when I can see for myself that that isn't readily available, I don't feel safe. What if a deaf person is otherly disabled and also maybe blind? You know, a deaf blind person is very different than someone who is blind and someone who is deaf. What if they are deaf, but they're also black, or they are, you know, any other person of color? It's a huge, huge concern, especially now. We see in Portland, our new chief of police, Danielle Outlaw, and her leadership. It's very concerning for me. I feel like she does not align with my vision of what Portland should be. We're on very, very separate pages, it feels like. And really, I want to emphasize, it's not just police, but it really leaks into any first responders. Do we have firefighters who are ready to respond to a deaf person in a fire? I myself spoke to my landlord and said, okay, how many alarms do we have? He said 4. Said you should have alarms ready with lights, and you should have people who you know that you can contact before anything else that can be prioritized to come and take care of the situation and warn people, you know, here's how your systems can improve. I gave them feedback of exactly how to talk to the first responders that he would be calling, so that they knew that deaf people were there, that people with other disabilities were there. You know, this is also ambulances and hospitals. You know, all of these issues of accessibility sort of leak into each other in terms of even employment and otherwise. So, you know, I love Portland. Please don't get me wrong, but Portland is one of the worst places for a deaf person to live because of just accessibility in general. Accessibility to public transportation, employment, hospital and medical, police, fire, you know, any emergency situation, you know. And now the political field is very hot. We have a lot of sensitive topics that are working their way through the Portland community, and live streams and videos of police activity and politician activity and the elections coming up, and everything that's going on in the world is often not accessible and doesn't have captions. So when we're talking about public events, when we're talking about anything being inaccessible, we're talking about leaving the deaf and hard of hearing community out of those dialogues entirely. And so I'm really trying hard to tackle each one of these at the same time, and push each one of them to understand that they are interconnected. And that was, you know, one of the platforms that I ran on for city council as well, was the accessibility on that level. Mm-hmm. Here in Portland, you know, maybe you and other people don't know, but we have absolutely no mental health services specifically for deaf and hard of hearing community. None. So if a deaf person is growing up with language deprivation and oppression through the education system and just systematically in general, you know, 90% of deaf Americans are raised by hearing parents. So this is, you know, a situation where they're growing up in a world that maybe doesn't accept them as a deaf person, depriving them of language, keeping them from their cultural identity, oppressing them, discriminating against them. Their inability to get that education leads to an inability to find a job. Maybe they are houseless. Maybe there's, you know, an encounter with a police officer, and then they're in a mental health crisis. And, you know, every level of the system fails them, and every level of the system is not transparent, and every level of the system is broken. And so the way that it affects the deaf and hard of hearing community is very unique and specific. And, you know, it's hugely concerning for me.
Can we talk a little bit, wrap back to Occupy for a few minutes here, and maybe just hear a little bit more about what for you were some of the most memorable moments, and how was that for you to be in a situation with Department of Homeland Security? There was a lot of violence against protesters in that movement. Do you have particular memories that really stand out about that?
Yeah. I have both good and bad memories, and I would say they're both equally important and relevant. Of course, it was scary to have DHS officers there with firearms directly pointed at us, standing on the roof, standing on the streets. There was a point at one time when I walked up to the police line with my hands up, and I just wanted to talk to whoever was in charge. I had an interpreter there, and I brought them there. I wanted to ask, what are you doing here? Why do you have guns? Why are you armed? Why are you standing here like this? You're yelling, and I'm deaf, and you have a weapon pointed at me. I want an explanation, because your talking is inaccessible to me. So I went up with my interpreter. I asked right up against the police line. They're pointing their guns at me. I had my hands in the air through my interpreter trying to explain, I just want to talk to somebody. I just want to ask a question. So finally, you know, some guy that was in charge came up and briefly let me explain who I was. I said, you know, I'm very, very calm. I was acting as calm as I could, but my heart was racing because I knew that any miscommunication could lead to an escalated situation. I could have been shot, you know. And so I got to ask him, you know, why are you doing this? Why are you here? And his answers were just, you know, it was just so easy to see how disassociated he already had been. He just already was answering and working through his mindset and didn't care what I had to say. So I, you know, backed myself up. But the moment of having those weapons pointed at my face was terrifying. Another memory I have actually is talking with someone who was on a loudspeaker, one of the occupiers. And I said, you know, do you mind if I sign? And my interpreter, you know, yells for me. And so they said, that's fine. And so we watched each other, and I watched that person's lips, and then tried to get, you know, with the pacing of their talking and teaching the sign language to the crowd so that we could all sign together and chant together. And, you know, having powerful moments like that where there was both languages going on, to have a whole crowd join me in speaking my native language while I was working around their native language, you know, obviously they saw something in me because I had been at the protest. They trusted me. They knew my passion, and I saw theirs. I saw their passion and their heart, and you know, we're just trying to make the world more equitable for all of us. And so having that ability to interact and experience with people, to be at their house, to invite people to my home, to have just community experiences. You know, if I see someone now in the street or in the store, at City Hall even, you know, we get to wave to each other. This is more people in the community that I know that I have this connection with, that I was able to develop there. And it really helped me, you know, get to the point where I am today. And we have a lot of people who are watching and listening to this, and I just love all of them who did that.
You've been listening to an interview with deaf activist and former 2018 Portland City Council candidate Philip J. Wolf, speaking about the groundbreaking work of providing access for deaf and hard of hearing activists at Occupy ICE PDX. A transcript and videotape of today's interview can be found on the KBOO Old Mall website, where you can also find a link to an earlier interview from 2 weeks ago with Andrew Tolman, who coordinated ASL translation at Occupy ICE PDX, and who interpreted for today's interview with Philip J. Wolf. Special thanks also to Andrew for his work for providing transcripts of both interviews. Thanks also to KBOO intern Sharina Nguyen for videotaping today's interview, and to Aaron Yankee for technical support for the interview. This has been Desiree Helgers for the Old Mall Variety Hour.
But I do want to keep talking. Because I think we haven't really even gotten to kind of talk a little bit about the disconnect between the kind of access that you were able to coordinate at Occupy and the lack of access that's pervasive in Portland, despite the resources that exist here. So I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
You know, my thoughts... Let's say you have someone who uses a wheelchair. Maybe you have someone who is pregnant. You know, maybe someone who uses an electric chair or a manual chair. You know, any person that you see, when you first see them, your first thought is, you know, oh, let me make sure that I have a ramp. Let me make sure this person can move through the area. You know, typically this is how an event would work. We don't see this same accommodation or consideration given to the deaf community. Many times we don't show up to protest because they're inaccessible, because it's a sensitive situation, because it's dangerous for us. And so because we're not seen, we're not thought of in the same way. And because there's not a continuous deaf presence, that accessibility is not provided. And so it perpetuates the oppression and becomes a pattern, and we become forgotten about. And so when the next event happens, you know, we don't think about what deaf needs are, figuring out where they should sit, whether or not there are interpreters or captions. You know, people get terrified about money. It's going to be so expensive. And so they just drop it and they focus and on other things and hope that no one is going to ask for it, you know, and then a deaf person asks for an interpreter and then they're stressed out and, you know, it's, oh, darn it, you know, I wish that they didn't ask me. And, you know, Occupy felt like it was the right time. It was the perfect opportunity to, like I said, plant that seed and to take advantage of how many people were watching us there. And I predict that there will be a change, slow and steady. Of course, it won't happen overnight. It will take a lot of time. But it was a great, wonderful start. So... yeah, I appreciate that opportunity.
Yeah, and do you feel like you're starting to see some changes come about as a result of Occupy? Yeah, can you talk a little bit about what changes?
Yes, yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's not just for public events. We want people to consider the accommodations, things that are available, because they should, you know. It would be nice if on flyers there was a way for someone to ask for accommodations. You know, now we're seeing it a little bit more where, like, on an event flyer, there'll be a little square that says, you know, for accommodations, contact this person or whatever. And oftentimes, though, that doesn't work out because even, you know, within a week or so of the event, they'll say that there's not enough time to work out those accommodations. So I am seeing the option there. Provided a little bit more, but when it comes to live captioning on videos, there are some people who are willing to provide transcripts after the fact. That helps out because there's not an ability for captions. So, you know, there are people that are considering it, and it's not every event. And it's impossible to think that overnight every event would, you know, start doing that. But I just want people to have that in the back of their head. If they can see another video that's inaccessible and then they are reminded about that accessibility, then that's, you know, a win for us. And we're trying to make those slow changes like that. And I think that it's really important for us to have a continued presence at City Council. You know, if they see Philip at a bunch of meetings, then they'll know that I need accessibility. And maybe they'll think of other deaf people and other hard of hearing community members when they are out at events doing other things, you know, with constituents. And every step is a huge step in the right direction. You know, every step is important. So we take what we can get.
Yeah.
And I mean,
go on.
Oh, you know, I just mean, like, I'm sure that, you know, now you've experienced an interview with a deaf person. And have you ever done that before
me? I've never done that before.
Right. So, you know, that's my point. That's why I'm here. You know, hello.
Yeah.
You know, rock on to being here. But yeah, you know, that's the point.
Yeah. And I think that raises all kinds of questions about sort of how to make radio itself more accessible.
Yeah. You know, I mean, today is perfect. We've got a great setup. We have interpreters. We have a video. We have people here who at KBOO, you know, staff and volunteers who are willing to get the resources, you know, and it's just the reminder, you know, how does an interpreter work out? How does a transcript work out? Let's talk about it. And we had a bunch of people here who are willing to do it. You know, I think it's important for people to understand that it is not safe to assume a deaf person will work out their own accommodation. situations. It's important if you don't know how to ask questions, but you should, you know, we should be providing that access for the deaf and hard of hearing community. Deaf people should not be doing it ourselves. You know, and I actually had a interview with KBOO during my city council election, my campaign, that did not have a transcript provided for us. And the deaf community was, you know, left out of their ability to hear my interview as a deaf candidate. And it did take a while. It did eventually happen, I think probably a good 2 weeks before the transcript was finally lifted. And I'm not trying to, you know, call out anybody. I'm not trying to say anything negative. I absolutely know this is a learning process, but I only mention it because for 2 weeks, the deaf community didn't have that information. And so they got that knowledge later than the general public. They're getting to work their way through that information, how they feel about it, 2 weeks late after it's already been processed, you know? And so it's important to keep the deaf and hard of hearing community up to date as much as possible. You know, those are small improvements that we could be making on a community level.
Yeah, and I think it was important for me to find out that, you know, the transcript is, you know, in an ideal world, the transcript isn't simply enough, right? That the ideal world is one where ASL is visible and is videotaped, which is what we're doing today, because it's involving, you know, a couple different phases or stages of translation to be reading the transcript for somebody whose first language is ASL.
Exactly. Yep.
So I know that obviously one of the big issues with dealing with police and, you know, with escalations of, you know, violence and police aggression is the expectation that the response time is going to be instantaneous when an officer gives an order, and that that's a huge threat to people who are deaf or hard of hearing, is just not being able to understand and immediately respond to an officer's command. So just a quick internet search, and I could find a few different instances of people who were fatally shot by police under those kinds of circumstances.
Yeah, I'd love to you know, start by mentioning that the media tends to sweep deaf and hard of hearing victims of police brutality under the rug. We do not get the recognition that we deserve because we're deaf, because it's a deaf and hard of hearing situation. So I would like listeners to know that police training in terms of interaction with deaf and hard of hearing, deafblind people, deaf with disabilities, is absolutely, you know, missing. You know, sometimes it's roped under public safety, but there's nothing that specifically addresses the interactions with deaf community members. I understand if a deaf person must be handcuffed, but they should be handcuffed in the front instead of the back. They are unable to sign or gesture when their hands are behind their back. So having that in front of them is so important. A lot of times when the deaf person is trying to just communicate, it's often misunderstood as aggression or resistance. A deaf person is also a visual person and often sometimes very tactile as well. So police are sensitive to that, and like I said, will think that this person may be resisting arrest, where really their body language or expression may be grammatical and cultural. And so when these cultures are clashing with each other, this police culture and this deaf culture, because the police are uneducated and not trained, and a deaf person may also not be trained or experienced with how to interact with an officer, you get an escalation that turns violent and dangerous. You know, so that's something I wanted to, you know, mention right off the bat. And secondly, too, as a deaf person who may be called by police to talk and be interviewed as a victim of a dangerous situation. I myself actually experienced a domestic violence situation with a hearing partner of mine. So they were hearing and I was deaf, and my partner was domestically violent against me. When the officers showed up, they did not follow ADA law. They interviewed my partner first, and my world was collapsing. You know, I was bleeding. My things were destroyed. My house, my world was turned upside down, and I had to work hard to just calm myself down enough so that the police wouldn't think that I was freaking out and escalate the situation even further. And on top of being a victim of this, I was re-victimized by this language deprivation, which, you know, manifested through the officers not providing an interpreter for me and instead interviewing my abuser before getting my story, before taking care of me and making sure that I was safe. They prioritized what this hearing person said, which of course he lied and was not transparent about what happened, and said that it was just a fight and that that we weren't partners, we were roommates. And so he lied enough that the police left. My partner then proceeded to beat me again and tried to kill me. The point that I'm trying to make is the police showed up again and wouldn't provide interpreters for me a second time during this situation that changed my life. I was victimized over and over and over again and had to fight hard not to lose it. I was so close to losing it. I didn't want to hurt my case because I wasn't able to communicate and empower myself through that language. You know, and luckily the officers arrived while, you know, he was assaulting me and he was placed in jail, and consequences did happen. But that's not the point. That whole second situation could have been avoided if accessibility and an interpreter was provided for me the first time. And I want to mention the second time, too, when the officers arrived, they were like, OK, fine. And mentioned, you know, called something into their radio. I knew he didn't have the resources to get an interpreter. I knew that officer didn't know what he was doing just from his body language, the way he was telling me, you know, hold on, calm down, hold on. I got it. It was 20 minutes later that actually another officer arrived, a female officer arrived, and started slowly signing with me like a level one student. Hi, I know little sign, help. And I just was floored. You know, in the middle of all this, that's what they provided with me, and that's what they thought was enough. So when we're thinking of a domestic violence situation, when officers showed up and they see, you know, the situation that I was in, they see this hearing person who knows sign language, they'll often ask the hearing person to facilitate communication. Now, what if that person is a child, a hearing child for deaf parents, who is then expected to facilitate communication as an interpreter? What if this person is not certified? What if there's a conflict of interest? I mean, if there's a child involved in a domestic violence situation, how can you expect them to properly interpret in that moment and provide access for their family and be able to be neutral and deal with all of those complexities? So, I mean, I can go on and on about real situations that happen to our community that would blow your mind. And it's a very, very serious disparity in terms of the training and experience that our officers are given to interact with the deaf and hard of hearing community. There's actually one story, if you don't mind, I'd like to share really quick. Portland has a deaf night out. It's called DNO. It's a monthly event that happens on the first Saturday of the month. Typically, we'll go to a different bar around the community. We like to hop around the Portland area so that we're exposing the hearing community to the deaf community of Portland and show that we're here. And we show up in bars and spaces around the city to hopefully broaden their horizons and you know, make future collaborations and community much stronger. So I remember several months ago, I arrived to a DNO. And there were two deaf people there that had an argument that was starting to escalate. One of the people there was very angry. They decided to try and get revenge on this other deaf person by calling the police on them and lying to them. So fortunately, I was standing outside And when the officers arrived with their sirens and lights on, and, you know, I think there were two or three cruisers that pulled up, I happened to know the officer that was there. So he knew that I was deaf. He knows that there's a bunch of deaf people there. And I prevented the officers from coming into the bar area because I knew that if they didn't know that this was a deaf event and there's a lot of signers and there's, you know, potential for miscommunication, that it would escalate it. So I took the time to hold them and type out on my phone a message explaining what the night was. This is a deaf event. They looked through the window and saw everyone doing sign language, like, oh, everybody here is deaf or using ASL, and they understood what they are about to walk into. And so I kind of just wanted to give that context before they walked in. I knew that that argument was going on, but I knew that it was nothing serious, that there was a miscommunication. And I asked the officers to go home because it wasn't a real dangerous situation. It had already ended. The officers took a look and they trusted what I said, and they ended up leaving that event. So just imagine if I wasn't there or someone was not there to de-escalate. It's possible that that could have gotten out of control. You know, I'm just, as a deaf person, I'm scared to think about what would have happened to make things worse if an assumption was made or anything like that happened. So,
yeah, I just want to say, too, I know that you have a critique, or I think you have a critique of, you know, the city council and prior elections, promises that are being made in terms of improving access in Portland and the failure to deliver. Do you want to talk about that issue at all?
Absolutely. First, I'd love to point out what I learned from my campaign experience. I was actually clueless to a lot of information until I was actually in the campaign itself. So the election is not transparent. It's not fair. It is not accessible. And I realized our education system and our our election system and our political system is for the white rich men to win. I know that historically we've seen these rich white men running for high office, while marginalized groups fail in every election to get this high office and higher positions in our city. Because, again, it is inaccessible, it is not transparent, and it is not fair and equitable. So it's these three systematic problems that I'm running against that manifest in the other candidates. And it's these issues that need to be addressed first and foremost in our elections here. So that was the first thing that I learned the hard way through my campaign. And yes, you know, I am willing to take that challenge. I'm willing to go through that struggle to figure it out. And I did. How can I figure out how to get there? How can I get to the end? How can I make it accessible for the future? And the things that I did succeed most in, though, I would say, is exposure. You know, that I can run. People saw that I was running. They saw where the deficits of access were, and I brought that to attention. I really made a lot of people, you know, eat crow in that situation and take steps toward making it better. And I'm not done. I'm going to run again next year. I'm, you know, watch out, all you people out there. But yeah, I'll be running again. So yeah.
Sounds like you were also just integrally involved in organizing the Deaf Forum recently. Do you want to talk about the goals behind that and any kind of outcomes that you might already see in the works from that forum?
I've been following politics for a number of years, not necessarily locally, but also nationally and internationally. And politics has never seen a deaf forum for a political campaign. I mean, truly never. When I say never, I mean this has never happened before. So as I was working my way through the campaign, I thought to myself, wait a minute. Why not switch the roles here? Why not flip the tables on the community on who typically hosts these able-bodied people hosting forums talking about issues that affect other communities? It's white people, and maybe a white woman will make her way in, and okay, perfect, we have a black forum now, and we have other forums now, but there was never anything for the deaf community. And as I was looking for it, I thought, you know what I should do? I should be careful not to, you know, appear... that I was trying to influence the community at all by hosting, you know, an event like this. But I wanted to bring the community together and host a deaf forum. So I got together with other deaf organizations here in Portland, described what the forums looked like that I had experienced. And we all kind of came to the agreement that because it had never happened before, this was the chance. So we all got together and provided resources. And then I actually stepped back because I wanted the forum to be neutral. I, you know, talked about what we would need in terms of a certified deaf interpreter working along with hearing ASL interpreters, making sure that we have microphones for hearing people that are in the audience, live captioning, deaf blind interpreters, and then put out the invite into the community and see what happens. You know, put it in, out into the mainstream audience, into the deaf community, and to all the other hearing candidates to come and be able to see it for themselves. I wanted to get this role reversal and give them a new perspective. And I think that that hit a lot of the candidates. Anyone who showed up, I think it hit them very hard, because most of the audience, 90% of them are people that know me through the deaf community, and having that opportunity to see my community there was so special and touching and important for me. And so when we sent out the blast to the public, we got public attention. Wow, deaf people can provide accommodations. I can be able to provide accommodations. You know, we did more than other people do. We had truly universal accessible universal accessibility there. We prioritized as many marginalized communities and disability communities as we could as a way to call out the general public about their lack of providing this accessibility for a number of years. And it was a challenge for my entire campaign working through those barriers, but it was a great opportunity to wake people up to the issue. So hopefully next time in next election cycle, we'll be able to see those changes. And it's exciting to be looking forward to that.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of a leading question, but do you see integral connections between anti-fascist organizing and the push for accessibility? I mean, I'm thinking, you know, about what seem to be, you know, very direct links between fascism and treating different communities as disposable.
So are you asking me a question just specifically about the roles of, like, Antifa and fighting fascism and how that relates to my fight against black accessibility?
Well, I wasn't thinking specifically about Antifa, but anti-fascist organizing more broadly, and whether, whether you see the struggle for access as integrally connected to the struggle against fascism.
Yeah, I could say that there are parallels to that. We're fighting for different reasons and in different ways, but we absolutely have parallel fights. Yeah. We're talking about fascism and anti-fascism, breaking that oppression and that injustice. Yeah, absolutely ties into the fight against, you know, oppression of the deaf community. But I think it's important to talk about the barriers of accessibility within that fight against fascism as well, needing to come down. Without accessibility, how can, you know, I as a deaf person really be anti-fascism? You know, it's a double level of oppression. My voice is taken from me in that fight because it's inaccessible. So, you know, that comes into play. I mean, does that answer your question?
Yeah, that definitely gets at it. But it's okay. It's also
good. Yeah,
it's also just sort of making me think about the lack of. I mean, we have so little idea what's going on inside these immigrant detention facilities, right? So presumably, we have very little statistics or any about people who have access issues inside, about people with disabilities inside, about the ways in which their oppression and their experience of being detained is exacerbated by those disabilities and by those access issues and by the lack of sign language interpretation.
Yeah, we absolutely, you know, don't think about that enough. And it's concerning to think about their accessibility needs being taken away from them in that situation, because that's the only voice that they have to protect themselves. It's the only, you know, voice that they have, you know, to prevent being taken advantage of. What if they're abused? What if they're raped? What if they, you know, are taken advantage of in any way? They now are unable to advocate for themselves. And that entire issue gets swept under the rug. And you know, we don't think about that enough. If there's, you know, parents, a mother, a father, a family, or whatever, if they have a deaf child, that deaf child is going to be tied to that family, the smell, the touch, the sight of them as a deaf child. The world is probably a scary place when you're making your way through those places. When they are ripped apart from that, what do you say? It's despicable. You know, how can a human think that anything like that is okay at any level?
For all the horror stories we're hearing about detention, I'm not hearing any discussion at all of children with disabilities and the particular struggles that they have.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, I've read a few articles related to deaf detainees, but those articles required a lot of research, a lot of curiosity of what, you know, was really going on, trying to find any bit of information. In comparison to the amount of stories that we have about the general public and people who are being held in these detention centers, we have a lot of media who are confronting people for interviews and finding people who got out and getting the information from them. But we don't have any, you know, of these survivors, you know, with disabilities or anyone who is deaf or hard of hearing. These are the stories we need to be bringing attention to. It's messed up. You know, feel free to bleep me here, but it is seriously fucked up. You know, it is fucked up. So.
I just want to think for a second here.
Whew.
Yeah. Have you had any calls or have you heard of any calls for sign language interpretation? Right. And I know, you know, Andrew is signing an ASL, right? But presumably that might not be the first call that we're getting for recent immigrants to the United States, right? They might not have English to begin with. So what are there other? Yeah.
Yeah. So just a little bit of clarification in terms of language. Signed languages from other countries or really any language translation from one into the other, providing that service and that facilitation of translating is not something that I'm very familiar with that process. I don't really know what it looks like. I know that resources are there, and often the detention centers and jails are supposed to be given those resources. Whether or not they provide them, you know, is not something I could speak about. But what I do know is about the providing an accommodation for a deaf person and a hard of hearing person or a deaf blind person. You know, oftentimes they just are detained with no consideration for that. You know, if the media found out that there was a violation of ADA within an detention center inside of a federal building, I mean, they don't want that kind of attention. So of course they're not going to provide information on that. It's the unseen, it's the unheard story of detainees who are there that the media does not see. They are deaf, they are hard of hearing, they are deaf blind, and they're there.
Yeah, are you hearing stories about experiences of deaf or hard of hearing people in Multnomah County Jail or in other jails around the area?
Yeah, what I know, and I may be wrong, please, you know, someone correct me if I'm wrong, but there are about 10 inmates who are deaf in Gresham now. Who are in prison right now, just for general, not necessarily a detention center, who are in prison currently. Some of them are in maximum security. There are people that are in immigration centers. But the point is that I've took a long time to try and contact these places to get accommodations for them. You know, I ask like, hey, are there captions on your televisions? Oh, no, our TVs are too old. Hey, do you have a video phone ready for someone to be able to make their legal phone call? Oh, no, we don't have that. So I'm thinking a deaf inmate has no option to contact their family, to contact a lawyer, to contact the outside world at all. And the police don't bother to think about that. The officers there and the staff there don't think that that's a priority, or none of the staff, that means, you know, for years have ever walked by and thought that that was a problem until someone complained about it. You know, and it took a deaf person to complain about it. And I already had to work through the communication barrier to even talk to them about it. You know, I mean, this is what I was talking about our voice being stolen just from trying to talk about the issues that affect us, that are stealing our voices. And you know, this is the point that we've kind of been talking about this whole time. You know, I actually have been placed in jail before because of a escalation from a miscommunication where I was arrested and put in jail in Las Vegas. And during the fingerprint and photograph process, there was no accessibility. I still to this, or during that time, I did not know why I was arrested. You know, for the entire processing, there was no interpreter. There was no explanation. I was ignored. I was tossed around. I was told how to stand and moved and then tossed into a cell and left with no explanation. 7 hours later, I finally got out. I went to the front desk to get my paperwork. It was a release at your own agreement, basically saying that I, you know, accept the charges and what had happened. And, you know, I'm supposed to sign it and give it back. And so I asked for a police report in ASL. And it was at that moment that the person at the front desk said, oh, my God, are you deaf? Oh, my God, I'm so sorry. Wait, you're a deaf person? And I'm like, let me get my police report, please. And so she brought the police report. And I was just so mad because the stories were completely incongruent. And it was one small miscommunication. And I could get into that maybe at a later date. But just the experience that I had, luckily I got out and I had the opportunity to advocate for myself and figure that out. But what if a person was in a similar, you know, domestic violence situation as me? What if someone actually committed a crime? What if it was thought that they committed a serious crime? What if it was any more serious, you know, situation than mine? You know, I've seen the way that police officers will shoot and hit people. We have deaf people who have been shot and killed, who have had their heads broken. You know, I have myself experienced calling for help in violent situations when people are hurt and, you know, trying to wait for police and you know, controlling a crowd in an escalated situation. I mean, I've experienced all of this myself and handled all of these types of situation, and I know that it's possible, and I know that, you know, even when I have blood on my hands literally from helping someone, there's a just no consideration for an interpreter to get my side of the story. I literally have written down, you know, police answers to police questions and interrogations on paper with blood on my hands after asking someone. As a deaf person, I require an interpreter. They are required by law to provide that. If I am a witness in a crime or any police situation, I should be given that accessibility. Not 2 hours later when they finally figure it out after they've already screwed up my schedule for the day and I'm willing to stay there and sit for 2 hours with someone who's traumatized from, you know, any type of situation. I literally, like I said, have experienced this where 2 hours later the interpreter shows up. Thank God they were certified, and I didn't have to send them back because of inexperience and not certification. And I, you know, every time that that interpreter has finally been provided to me, I'm given pertinent and valuable information that I could have used 2 hours before, that I could have needed 2 hours before. You never know what could be pertinent in that kind of information. So deaf people need to not be shy about that. You know, in a law situation, in any legal situation, an interpreter needs to be there. And if they're not, the result can be very different. So, you know, it's important to be thinking about that all the time.
Yeah, should we spend just a couple more minutes maybe talking about medical access issues? Because
sure thing.
I gather that, you know, a bad translation can result in in an incredibly, you know, can be a fatal error.
Oh, yeah. Something I want to clarify. The problem is not the interpreter. The problem is not the interpreting process. The problem is often people like on a board who have decision-making powers, who make contracts with interpreting agencies and other accommodations, and how they handle these types of situations. Oftentimes these boards are represented by hearing people and not deaf people or anyone with disabilities. So they are speaking for what our community needs without including us in the dialogue. So oftentimes they'll work with an interpreting agency who is the cheapest because they provide many different spoken languages and ASL, and they think that this is a benefit. When you have added ASL into a lot of these spoken language agencies, the screening processes are terrible, and so you end up with underqualified interpreters who are just used because they're cheap. So a contract is signed and the hospital works with them. There are, you know, in a perfect world, there would be an agency run by deaf people. And even when there are deaf-led agencies, maybe they're more expensive because of the good service that they provide. And so the hospital would choose convenience and cost over certification, qualification, and actual accommodation. We need people in decision-making seats that are from our community making those decisions for us with those other board members and bringing to attention how important it is. And you know, it would be so much easier and it would be at their benefit to set up these services. But they'd, you know, rather set up a system like a VRI, which is, you know, like a video relay interpreter, which, you know, isn't always going to work because you have terrible Wi-Fi and internet access in a hospital. It's also a person in a screen, so you aren't able to see there, see this person and what's going on in the room. I mean, imagine if a deaf person was stabbed and they had to look at this iPad for access, or if you're having a baby and you need to look at an iPad for your interpreter. You need a live person that can be there, that can personally assess the room and the situation and move and provide access. You have this lag, you have bad Wi-Fi that's causing, you know, a lag or a mistranslation, a miscommunication. It would just be so much easier to provide an interpreter in that moment and go through it, but they think that this would be easy. Oh, I have this VRI, I have this little screen, that's hospital policy, sorry. And deaf and hard of hearing people are stuck because now this is the policy. And that policy had to come from somewhere. This is board members discussing and setting policies that, again, are not including deaf representatives and disabled representatives. And so when you're talking about health, whether mental health or physical health, any kind of health access, there's a huge disparity. So then think about maybe a deaf-blind person. When you have a deaf-blind interpreter, you are using a tactile sign language. VRI cannot provide tactile sign language. There are not arms attached to that iPad to provide that for somebody. And so I could go more and more in depth, and that would take up a lot of time. But I just want to scratch the surface enough for people to start thinking about that and really take it deeper, because those problems actually exist, and we actually have people living in those situations that need to get better. And it's unfortunately an uphill battle. It's vertical at this point, so...
Yeah, I think we should probably wrap up so we don't get kicked out of the studio on a kind of, you know, split second moment. But
yeah, no problem.
Can you tell our listeners how they could get in touch with you if they want to learn more about your organizing, if they want to support your work, and if you want to give resources to other organizations that people could plug into if they want to kind of work on making and supporting some of these structural changes in Portland?
Email works best. So philipjames73@hotmail.com. So philipjames73@hotmail.com. And again, my name is Philip, spelled with one L. So that's why I spelled it and really wanted to emphasize Philip with one L, james73@hotmail.com. Please feel free to email me anytime. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. Philip J. Wolf is my at handle. Again, with one L on Philip. Yeah. Or, you know, if... you want to meet in person, you know, you'll probably see me at City Hall every Wednesday, so we can meet there.
Great. Well, Phil, thank you so much for joining me today. And Andrew Tolman, thank you so much for interpreting for us.
Thank you again for having me here. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to add a voice to our community and for your listeners to really see and hear this for themselves and hopefully make changes and see how they can ask. You know, I couldn't truly ask for more than this empowering sort of opportunity. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you.